Welcome to The B Word, the podcast about humans, organizations, behavior. I'm your host, James Healy. Don't forget to leave us a rating or a review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Imagine for a moment that fish could talk. No, seriously, work with me here. Imagine trying to explain to a goldfish in a bowl on your counter that it's swimming in water. "But I can't see the water," says the goldfish. "That's because it's totally transparent, but trust me, it's all around you." "Yeah, I'm really not sure I believe you, to be honest," says the goldfish. The thing is, we're all the goldfish. We're all surrounded by an invisible set of norms, assumptions, and beliefs. Things that we totally take for granted that we can't see and don't notice. Often, even if they're pointed out to us. Every organization has ways of doing things that nobody questions, that developed long ago, deep in the mists of time, for reasons long forgotten. Organizational life in general is much the same. So many facets of everyday working life are based on assumptions that we just take for granted. But are those assumptions accurate? Do these things actually work? Is there any real basis for shared values, performance reviews, leadership training, personality testing, and the like? What would happen if we took a more rigorous approach? Thought critically, looked outside in. What if the fish could see the water? These are the questions that today's guests like to ask. Byron Benbara and Philip Jordanoff are the co-founders of Neurofied, a behavioral science consultancy based in the Netherlands. Byron and Philip are the co-authors of two books. Together, they wrote The Dynamics of Business Behavior, an evidence-based approach to managing organizational change. And along with Paul Gibbons, Tricia Kennedy, myself, and a host of others, they co-authored The Future of Change Management. I'll let Byron and Philip give a fuller introduction themselves, but before I do, I should just mention that we had some technical challenges recording this episode. So what you're listening to is actually take two. Hopefully, doing a full dress rehearsal beforehand makes this episode even more enjoyable. Philip, Byron, welcome back. Take two.
Thank you very much, James. Good to be back again. And let's hope that the gods of tech side with us today.
Indeed. Fingers crossed our robot overlords treat us well. So thank you both very much for joining me. Very excited to talk to you both. I want to start by just asking you to give a little bit of context about what you guys do at Neurofied, how you got into it, and just a little bit about the book, which the listeners have just heard me describe briefly, but keen to hear from both of you what drove you to write the book and sort of what's the key message of the book.
Nice. Yeah, I think I can kick off. So I'm Byron, the founder and CEO of Neurofied, which in a small company means that you're 50% visionary, 50% you're doing whatever is necessary. I think it's interesting maybe to take a step back because the book is, of course, the end result or one of the milestones of the company. And I think it's interesting to go a bit back in terms of why did we even start the company? And maybe even a little bit before then, why did we both get interested in psychology and behavioral science? And one of the patterns that we've seen that we just talked about is kind of dual background. So Philip is half Bulgarian and half Dutch, and I'm half Tunisian, so North Africa and half Dutch. And we both grew up with seeing different families, right? Different cultures, different rituals, different ways of being, different ways of thinking, different ways of making decisions. I think that shaped us quite a bit. And we see it still in the team, like multiple people in the team, they have dual backgrounds, or they have at least lived abroad. And I think that triggers some kind of basic curiosity about why are people the way they are and why does that differ across geographies, across cultures. And I think that is one of the first steps. And then for me personally, I did martial arts at quite, I was a relatively scared kid. So my dad put me on karate to gain a bit of confidence. And I'm also quite an obsessive guy. So that led to me getting some prizes at the world stage. And all of that kind of broke my worldview because I thought of myself as the scared kid. And then suddenly you're third at the world championship in the fighting part, which is the exact opposite. So your identity kind of gets remade. And I think all of that made me think, on the one hand, what else is there that I can achieve? Which in my case, I wanted to be an entrepreneur. So I think that explains why even a business. And then the other side is, I like reading a lot. And I read a lot of books, mainly on entrepreneurship, psychology, and technology. And I noticed that everything I learned in terms of psychology, the basics, because I didn't study it, I studied international business administration, that all of the basics were very useful for me in terms of understanding why certain things in my martial arts career were working and why other things weren't working. And it helped me explain how things work. And at some point, I noticed that it's a very similar pattern in business where a lot of people are actually operational psychologists, but they don't necessarily understand the theoretical underpinnings of why things work. So I think if I were to summarize all of that, we're both interested in how humans think, decide, and act. And that led to Neurofight after some while. And the idea was just democratizing the value of behavioral science, making sure that more people can benefit from the science that is already being done. And then there's a bunch of approaches about that, but we'll talk about that more. So from here on, I'll give it to you, Philip.
Thank you, Bayem, for that awesome introduction. So my name is Philip. I'm a behavioral scientist. My background is in cognitive neuropsychology. And it's always easy to say in hindsight, right? But what got you into it? But I do think, James, what you were just referring to, that the bicultural element, having a father from Bulgaria and a mother from the Netherlands, it just exposes you to all these subtle differences in communication, in how they give feedback to their children. And I'm thinking about it even more now because I just got back from Copenhagen to provide a training on cultural differences in feedback. And we were working with a global healthcare company. They had a big team that was growing and was undergoing a lot of changes. There were people with different nationalities from India, from Poland, Denmark, even France. And we dived into one way in which you can subdivide cultural differences in terms of directness versus indirectness, and then implicit versus explicit communication. And there are all these different quadrants that are appearing, right? And we had fascinating conversations about, yes, I am in this quadrant because in where I come from, we communicate with way more, implied structures. We want people to read between the lines. And I noticed myself when I was facilitating this training that I was both in a quadrant where you communicate very directly and explicitly, which is kind of Dutch, right? The Danish are similar. But also I was in the more Bulgarian quadrant where you're still direct, but you're way more implicit in your communication. You imply things. You want people to read between the lines. And that made it even so much more fun to give that particular training. And it made one in one for me. That is really how I got into psychology, how I got into behavioral science, and probably also how I got into really wanting to take that out of the academic context and into the space where you can apply it to solve some real world problems, right? Both in society, but also in organizational contexts.
Thank you both. There's so much to unpick there. I'm going to jump immediately on the bicultural thing. There's a book I read many years ago, Seven Pillars of Wisdom by T.E. Lawrence. So Lawrence of Arabia. If you've not seen the film, it's a great but very long film. Fun fact, Steven Spielberg said it's the greatest movie ever made, and he knows a thing or two about movies. But the book is the account of a British officer in the First World War who acts as the liaison to the Arab army, who are fighting as a sort of loose ally of the British against the Turks. And there's this passage in the book that has always stuck with me where Lawrence talks about living among the Arab army, wearing their clothes, speaking their language, essentially adopting all of their rituals, almost becoming one of them. But he talks about how no matter how much he tried to wear that mask, no matter how much he tried to become one of them, he would always be an outsider. And that enabled him to view things with a little bit of detachment. He could have more objectivity than if he were really one of them. But it also had the knock-on impact that when he finally got back to Britain, he found himself an outsider there too. And he was unable to lose that kind of objectivity, that kind of separation. And it's a passage that's always stuck with me because it predates most of what we would now call anthropology, but it almost perfectly describes that participant observer role that is at the core of anthropology and ethnography. And those disciplines are all about observing humans, about observing human behavior. And it's always occurred to me that in a consulting role in an organization, you are in many ways an anthropologist, even if you don't know that term or you don't think of yourself in that way. You are essentially there immersing yourself in the culture of the organization, taking part in their rituals, speaking their language, but you're always an outsider. And I think it's fascinating that both of you have this bicultural background and that many of your team have this similar bicultural background, because I think we're all, when working with organizations and looking at behavior, we're all anthropologists.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I think you're totally right there. That's absolutely one of the elements. And that's not to say that it cannot be the case when you're not bicultural, right? Like, I've seen a lot of the most brilliant psychologists, but that's what you're talking about in, it's also the traveling. Like for me, it was also when I was 18, I lived in Japan for half a year and studied at a university there. Well, things are different, right? Like in the house where I lived, we had Oka-san and Oto-san, like the dad and the mom, and you could not call their names. You would not even know their names. You would call them mom and dad, right? So it's all of those implicit structures. And the more you taste, the more you can see how the spectrum evolves and how the quadrants develop, essentially, right? Like how far can the human mind stretch in terms of what is normalcy in that sense and what might not be? And you also, I think, very implicitly start seeing, and it takes a lot more effort to make that explicit, right? But you start seeing how things that are the exact right approach in one culture might be the exact wrong thing to do in another. So yeah, it's the nuance, the contextual differences.
I love that idea of the amateur anthropologist that you mentioned, James. And it reminds me of a colleague in the field, Thijs Bejeu, who is this guy is like a PhD in behavioral science from Harvard. He's a psychologist background. But what I like when I talk to him is that he often mentions that he's so excited to go into organizations as an external, because then he can feel like the amateur anthropologist. And that's what gets him most excited. So I really like that frame.
Yeah, I'm going to stretch the anthropology thing just a little bit further. I recently read something by Wade Davis, who's a very renowned anthropologist. He has a great title. He is a National Geographic Explorer in Residence. I mean, who wouldn't want that as their job title?
Right.
But he writes that every human culture is essentially an attempt to answer the question of what it means to be human and alive. And I think that's very profound. And I think there's a lot of accuracy to that. I think in an organizational context, you could draw a parallel and say almost every organization is an attempt to answer, it wouldn't be the same question, but to answer two or three fairly consistent questions. How do we motivate, how do we organize a bunch of people to do X? And just as Wade Davis points out, every culture in the history of humanity has found a different answer or a different set of answers to that. So too do organizations find a different way of answering the same question. And even two organizations in exactly the same industry in exactly the same country, while they might consciously borrow from each other, they will have inadvertently found different ways of answering those same core questions.
Yeah. That's a beautiful way of looking at it. And also just interesting to think about how the cultures of a country, they develop relatively slowly, right? Whereas the culture of an organization is much more fast-paced. And also the organization is an amalgamage of people from different cultures. So you start to see how all those cross-cultural tendencies, how they develop, how they fit into each other, how they might clash, and how it evolves over time into something that's, by definition, more hybrid, you know?
Oh, I like this so much. There could be like a whole collection of behavioral scientists defining organizations, because James, I like how you put it. The organization should be able to answer the question of what it means to be a human being. And I think the late Danny Kahneman describes organizations as they should be factories for decision making. I don't know if the organizational leadership would agree with all those decisions, but I definitely do. I love this frame and looking at it from that angle.
And the funny thing is that from an entrepreneurial perspective, I think of organizations essentially as problem-solving machines. There is something in the world that is not optimal, and the organization exists for the reason of solving that problem. And then the next question is, how do you solve that problem, right? It's like, so it's interesting to see how all of that, is it more about the progress? Is it more about the value of humans in that organization? And that also differs across cultures. It's a fascinating conversation.
I think to bring all of these things, all of these threads together, one of the things that any anthropologist, any participant observer, any outsider is able to do is to question assumptions, question the underpinning assumptions, question the received wisdom. And there are a lot of assumptions underpinning any organization, underpinning any facet of an organization. I'm going to get very specific here. And obviously, the listeners have heard me say in my introduction to both of you that we met through co-authoring the book, The Future of Change Management. So I'm going to bring this to change management straight away. There are a lot of traditional assumptions underpinning the way that change management has always been done. And if I think about your other book, I think you do a great job of unpicking some of those assumptions and talking about evidence-based change and proposing a number of evidence-based strategies that practically apply behavioral science. We're going to get to those strategies. But before we do, I think it'd be good to have a discussion about some of those underpinning assumptions. And particularly some of the underpinning assumptions that possibly need an update, or frankly, possibly need completely ripping up.
Yeah, let's dive into that. And, you know, for some context, Bayram and I, we've been trying to figure out, you know, what are the most productive areas to apply behavioral science to? And, you know, there's no clear answer to that. But the questions that we got quite often in the last years from people that we know professionally is, can you come help this problem in our organization? Because everything is changing so rapidly. So our company, Neurofight, is really focusing right now on trying to bring those insights and frameworks and interventions from behavioral science to the use cases of change management, managing change in organizations. And one of the things that, you know, the behavioral scientists love to do is to challenge and try to debunk assumptions. While there, I think that there are so many, we don't have time at all to address all of them, but two that I think are quite important, first and foremost, and, you know, definitely not the first one to say this on the podcast here, is this idea of seeing people as economic machines, the image of the Homo economicus, which I think originally came from John Stuart Mill and hundreds of years ago, where, you know, we see people as this, you know, rational beings, logical in the way that they make decisions. They do this cost-benefit thing all the time when they choose something so that it's in their best interest. And they don't really make mistakes in that. But, you know, right now we know that this is not really how you and I and the people around us operate on a daily basis. And even though we see companies and organizations, you know, stating that they are becoming more human-centric, right, more attention for the people inside, and there might be a ping pong table and there might be a beanbag in the corner. But even though you still see that a lot of the processes, the systems, the policies are still anchored to that idea of human beings being logical economic entities instead of people, right? Instead of people that have emotions, that have heuristics, that maybe have some biases when they make decisions. And I think that even though this is something that we got to talk about a lot more in the past decades, since we got, you know, works like Nudge and then Thinking Fast and Slow all these years, I guess already almost 20 years ago that these books came out. But still, if you would ask me, this idea of humans as the economic machine still lives very prevalently in organizational systems, processes, and policies. So if we can change those contexts, those environments even more, and go from not just saying that you are a human-centric company to actually being behaviorally informed, to designing those processes and systems and policies in such a way that they encourage people to make better decisions, that they encourage engagement and good leadership support and learning and development in organizations, I think we still have ways to go there, which is good because otherwise we would be out of a job. And then another assumption that I would love to highlight, and I know that you write very eloquently about this in your chapter in the book that we wrote together, James, The Future of Change Management. And we also address this in our book, the Dynamics of Business Behavior, Culture as Values or Values as Culture assumption. Where in today's world, we see organizations changing very rapidly and constantly, and they're dealing with complexity and uncertainty and all these words that we've heard so many times. But what it comes down to is that they understand that their culture has to change as well. And they keep having these conversations about, you know, what are our values as a company? What are our norms? Can we write them down? How we value collaboration and synergy and integrity and entrepreneurship. And, you know, I love the sound of these words, but what do they mean? And especially, what do they mean behaviorally? What does it mean when you say we need to be more collaborative? Can you translate that into something that I can see a manager do on a Monday and that I then on a Tuesday see employees copy from him or from her? So that role modeling behavior, how can you extend the conversation further than just like this stone slab of values to actual tangible, measurable, objective behaviors? Because if we can't talk about specific behaviors, then how are we going to see change? In 6 months, we can have the conversation. So it would become more collaborative and entrepreneurial, and everyone would have a completely different idea of that because we didn't express it in behaviors. And what we notice, and I think you have a great Tom Peters quote in your book, where, you know, one of the proponents, one of the early figures in this, the value and culture relationship, they were very aware of the fact that it shouldn't just be ambiguous terms, that they should be more specifically, more context related. But I think sometimes that idea has kind of, you know, lost touch with a lot of professionals. So we are really trying to focus on that, to correct that assumption that we should be talking about more than just those shared values, that the shared values are not ultimately what defines a culture. In our book, we were still a bit more nuanced about this, but I think today we would definitely say, at least I would definitely say, that cultural change is about behavioral change. If you want to change culture, you should change behavior. And if you want to change behavior, then you need to change the environment in which that behavior occurs.
Yeah. And all of this is also a testament to how fast and how rapidly the field is growing, right? Like both the scientific understanding as well as the business practices, because the book was written last year. And even in that short time frame, things still change. And also maybe to add one thing, because I think you broke it down perfectly, is how these assumptions might change in an organization, that also differs per aspect. So it's leaving the structure, in our experience at least, it's leaving the structures much more slowly than it's leaving the communication. So a lot of managers, they tend to kind of be aware of this. And then in the marketing of the organization, there's a lot of human-centric sides. But then when you're in the performance review, it's a lot different, right? So I think it's also about aligning the processes. And maybe to simplify this even, so if we say human-centric, what we mean is making sure that the processes in an organization and the way that is communicated and the way that people behave around one another, that all of that is aligned with how people tend to be intuitively, right? So it should take less effort. It should take less effort to understand how things work. It should take less effort to do the things that you need to do. And with evidence-based, we kind of mean that you don't just shoot spaghetti at the wall, but that you actually learn from what we have done in history, right? Like there has been a bunch of science, which is very useful, but it's in the lab. So we cannot be sure that this is replicated in real life. And then there have been a whole bunch of experiments in the real world, which have not been scientifically proven. And it's kind of finding your way in between those two fields and seeing, making sure that you are more certain that the things that you will be doing are useful. And I think to tie all of this to the book and kind of explain how we went about it is we interviewed a bunch of executives and change managers and people in HR and organizational development and tried to put a lot of context around some of the challenges they were having, especially when it comes to change. And you can think of change fatigue. So people becoming overwhelmed by the amount of change and the continuous side of change. And based on the science and what has worked in the past, we essentially made it a toolkit. So whereas some say every manager needs to know behavioral science, we think it's almost impossible to expect from corporate managers that they also have this entire background in behavioral science. What's much more logical is giving them a toolkit which already has the behavioral science imbued in it, right? So you can give them a toolkit. And in the book, we kind of broke down 18 what we call evidence-based interventions or evidence-based change interventions, but in short, things you can do to improve something that is already there and do it in a more human-centric and more evidence-based way. And then for managers, can be a change manager, but essentially anyone who is leading change in organizations, they can add those tools into their toolkit and know that some of these will be useful some of the times.
Thank you. I really want to pick up on the evidence-based part of this, because there may be some listeners who are reacting slightly quizzically to that phrase, and they may be asking themselves, what do you mean evidence-based? Surely everything that we do in organizations is evidence-based. All of these practices, whether it's policies, processes, e-learnings, performance management, all of these things have been around for years. Surely they're evidence-based, no?
Oh, yes, I love this, James. And I think I would not disagree with that, because everything is based in some form of evidence, right? And you have anecdotal evidence as well. So if you have an executive decision maker that is reading the paper in the morning, wherever they may be, and they read something interesting, or maybe it's not the paper, it's another form of information, and they think, well, I should immediately implement this in my company, then, you know, you could say that that is based on some form of anecdotal evidence. But then the question you should ask is this the type of evidence that I want to base my decisions on? You would think that. But then again, you know, if we were very economical and very logical in our decision making, we would always base our approaches to change and to organizational management and development on the best available evidence. But then we see a lot of tools, materials, frameworks, and we're not going to name any names here, that are so prevalent and that work with, you know, very fun materials and the different colors to express things. And you notice that this is great in getting the conversation going, and it's great in getting ramping up some engagement, and it's oftentimes fun. They might tell you something about your personality, but never negative things about personality. But if you do a personality test at a psychologist, sometimes something very negative can come out of that. You know, you're high in neuroticism, you're very low to openness. You will not find those in these instruments in, for example, HR. But, you know, they get the conversation going, but then sometimes these tools or these interventions or these programs are overextended to contexts in which they shouldn't be used. Like, for example, hiring or promotion, or who we should see as competent employees or not competent employees. And here's where things get a bit, you know, slippery, or maybe unfair or inequitable. And this is where making sure that the tools and materials and interventions that you apply, you know, your people, the people that you work with, are rooted in insufficient evidence. When we talk about evidence-based, you know, the textbook definition would be to base your decisions and approach on the best available rigorous scientific evidence that has also been field tested. But of course, you have some degrees of freedom there as well. You cannot you cannot wait for every little intervention tool, program, training that you roll out to be rooted in peer-reviewed, randomized controlled trial research. So there are different forms of evidence that you can take into account. Case studies and success stories, business cases from other parts of the industry can be used as evidence base, especially when you combine them with scientific empirical, you know, maybe peer-reviewed evidence. But in the book, as Bayram said, we interviewed over 40 leaders. We used to, you know, the standardized psychological style of interviewing, and we got a lot of interesting insights from them. And we would also say that that is a form of evidence that you can base your approach on. So I would not want to limit organizations to saying you can only use things that have been fully peer-reviewed and grounded in the most robust and empirical evidence. You can use different sources of evidence, but you have to see, you know, am I working with something that has been validated somehow, that has been proven in the real world, that has some ties to making a difference? And that is what we try to use as compass for selecting the 18 evidence-based interventions in our book. And all the other, you know, we work with many more interventions when we do training, consulting, change programs, implementation. We always try to pick the best evidence available while not limiting ourselves and to the most robust randomized controlled trial peer-reviewed stuff. So I would say I understand that there is a bit of confusion and that there are some degrees of freedom there. It is more complex than it seems.
Yeah. And maybe to add one small thing here, which is interesting, there's also the relationship between innovation and science, or innovation and evidence-based approaches. Because if you oversimplify, you could say that evidence-based is anything that has already been tried a bunch of times widely enough that it was worth doing scientific testing on. And then, and only then, once that a lot of organizations have applied it and a lot of scientists have analyzed it, you can apply it. So if you take it to the extreme, you could say that an organization with only evidence-based practices is never innovating, right? So there's always that kind of balance between you want to update some of the outdated processes and improve them with something that is more evidence-based, but at the same time, you do want to innovate. And we think that science can actually play a big role there. But then we're talking more about a different side of things, where you use the theories and the insights and the interventions and combine them in a novel way so that you're taking a novel approach. So I don't think that an evidence-based approach is by definition less innovative, but I would also say that if you want to build the best organization possible, it would not only include evidence-based approaches. And some of the things that you might be trying, some of the spaghetti at the wall might become evidence-based, but only in 20 years once it's been tested. So you also want to be mindful of the balance between those interventions.
That's a really good addition. And I recognize a lot from what our colleagues in the field at Ogilvy are saying about this. James, you know them, Rory and Sam. I think one of them, I don't know who of them said this, is that, you know, they try to be very robust and evidence-based in the way in which they create their campaigns and their services at Ogilvy. But then I think Sam said it, Sam Tatum, we're not in the business of replication, we are in the business of innovation. So I think this does make a lot of sense. What are your goals, and what are the goals to which you want to apply those evidence-based interventions? Because if your goal is to replicate them, to make sure that there is more, a bigger bound of empirical evidence saying, yeah, these interventions work very well in this controlled setting, then probably you want to be a lot more robust and controlled than when your goal is to, you know, transform the culture of an organization or create a campaign that will shift the viewpoint in society about topic A, B, or C. So this conversation, it doesn't have one answer, and it's very interesting.
Yeah, I feel like I'm just about to continue name-checking previous podcast guests. You've obviously named Rory, but I'm going to now give a shout-out to both Dilip Soman and also Matt Waller, who both say something similar. I now forget who said it first, perhaps neither of them, but it's behavior as an objective, science as a method. And the point they're trying to make, both of them, is it's not, as you say, Byram, it's not just about lifting things that have been replicated 50 times in a psychologist's lab and then doing them exactly as they were done in those experiments. It's as much about treating measurable behavioral change as the outcome that you're looking for, and using the scientific method, which is all about trying things and seeing if they work, and that being the way that you apply science in organizations rather than just lifting, shifting experimental techniques. Before we go on, I'm going to come back, Philip, to something you said, and thank you for not libeling any large organizations on the podcast. I appreciate that. I did want to pick you up, though, on your quip about the color-based personality test and just make the point to the listeners that that comes from a very credible source, because the person who created that best-selling global personality test was also the man who created the comic character Wonder Woman. And I can't think of a more appropriate person to be designing corporate tools and techniques than such a figure.
You had me sweating there for a second.
Beautiful. Yeah.
So how do we segue from Wonder Woman? Well, I'm going to ask now, in terms of evidence-based approaches, in your experience, both of you, how open do you find organizations are to trying more evidence-based approaches? Do you find resistance to these approaches, and do you find there's a tendency to rely on the things that we've always done?
I can answer that real shortly, and then maybe, Bam, you can elaborate on me.
Go for it.
What we noticed is that it has two sides, because on a small group level and on an individual level, when we look at professionals and organizations, we encounter relatively little resistance. They're quite excited. They're quite keen to start working with these, you know, new tools and interventions and add them to their toolkit, expand their knowledge and skill. On an organizational level, we encounter more resistance. And I think that is due to main barriers, and I think that there are a lot more, but to just start with these two, is that oftentimes organizations' incentive structures are not really aimed at having managers and decision makers experiment with new evidence-based interventions to their problems. And you can look at that and dissect that in many ways you want, but oftentimes the key incentives, the key performance indicators, are not really aimed, you know, you need to hire these behavioral scientists and they're going to help you experiment with a lot of new ways of working. Sometimes they are, but let's say in general there is a bit of a disbalance in how these new experiments and these new ways of working are incentivized. And then the second is the cost of experimentation in organizations are still relatively high. And that is not just monetary cost, but also interpersonal risk that might be at play. People might feel scared that they get reprehended, that it might impact them negatively when they choose for a more innovative experimental approach and, let's say, you know, set aside $20,000 for an experiment. No one would look at them weird if they take $500,000 or more out of a budget to just roll with a plan or an organization or a consulting group that they've worked with many times before. And this is where you gave a shout out to Dilip Soman. One of the things that I love most from him is that he says we need to bring the cost of experimentation down in organizations. When we can do that, we'll see that a lot more room comes into being for experimenting with real, like, behavior-based interventions, behavioral science in different areas of the organization, and work to that idea of his, the behaviorally informed organization.
Yeah. Yeah, you're totally right, Philip. And I also think that, well, first off, to emphasize, you're absolutely right about that professionals individually tend to be much more willing to try all of this. And the amount of times that we had people very interested and they said, okay, so I'm going to try this intervention here. And then they come back to us 3 weeks later saying it's impossible because of a combination of either the upper level director who is not accepting it, the current processes where it doesn't fit in, the urgency of other projects. So it's that whole combination. And I would even go a bit further in saying, even when there is interest, right? So, well, maybe before that, I think one of the big challenges of applying science to organizations is that science, and I'm oversimplifying a bit here, but it can be too fluffy and too abstract and too theoretical. And that's what I see a lot of behavioral scientists. So they are highly aware. They have huge, like, absolutely a lot of knowledge on how all of this applies, but it's very far from the practical reality that, for example, a change manager or a change leader is experiencing on a daily basis. So it, I think a big part that the scientists can do is in making it much more practical. And at least that's what we aim to do at Neurofight, making things extremely practical. And a toolkit for us seems very logical. But even when, let's say that there's a very practical challenge. So two organizations are merging, or one is acquiring the other. So you have two separate cultures. Those cultures need to integrate in some way. And there are cultural differences. Let's take the example of one organization has always had a bigger budget, so they tend to throw money at problems in order to solve them, whereas the other has always been a bit more the underdog and tends to be more a bit more entrepreneurial. So it's not leaning on resources as much as it's focused on trying to be resourceful within the situation there is. How do you approach that, right? And let's say that the internal change manager or the HR director is already working on a culture program. Usually what we see is that even when we as behavioral scientists get involved, we get involved too late. We get involved at the point where the strategy is already set in stone, and all we can do is review the plans, but we cannot overhaul them. And we can implement some interventions, but that is not at the strategic level. And what I'm happy to see is that in recent years, I do feel like there's a slow shift towards behavioral scientists being more involved in the strategy phase of things. And I think that's where you can actually change the most, right? So when you're looking at where is the value, it's in providing the context. It's in making sure that the guiding principles underlying everything you do are a bit more evidence-based.
Yeah, I'd say the key word there, Byron, is it's context. And it goes back to the Kahneman quote that Philip, you mentioned earlier, every organization, no matter what else they do, is a factory that manufactures decisions, a factory that manufactures behaviors. Fundamentally, every aspect, small and large, of that organization, and we talked at the beginning about culture, but every aspect of that organization, from the processes to the policies, the systems, even the physical environment, the location, the org structures, the job titles, et cetera, all of those things that form the fabric of the organization, all of those things influence behavior. And much of the time, we don't necessarily think about that. Sometimes we do in organizations. Sometimes we're designing, say, an incentive program or a control in a process very specifically to try and influence behavior. But oftentimes, I'm not sure that organizations necessarily think about the impact of all of those different aspects. And I'm sure everyone listening to this has got examples from their own lives, from their own careers, where the stated goal in some particular sphere of their organization was X, but the incentive structure drove them to do not X, and the process and the systems made them do not X. And everyone scratches their head and wonders, why are people not doing X? I think the other thing I'll pick up on that you both talked about there, and particularly Philip, you talked about almost the risk aversion, and the often the incentives in an organization lead towards taking the less risky option. It's not necessarily, and this sounds hugely cynical, but it's not necessarily about doing the thing that works. It's about doing the thing that everyone expects me to do because I can retrospectively justify that. Famous quote from the economist John Maynard Keynes, a sound banker is not one who avoids risk. It's one who, when he is ruined in the same way as all of his fellows, so that no one can blame him.
Absolutely.
And it's not just a comment about banking, it's a comment about human nature.
Beautiful highlights.
Couldn't agree more. Very depressing.
So I'm conscious of time, and I'm also conscious of not ending on a completely depressing note. So do you both want to talk a little bit about some of those practical techniques? I know you have 18 in the book, and I know there's many more up both of your sleeves, but do you want to talk about just one or two examples of evidence-based interventions that you recommend people listening to this might want to try in their own organization, whether it's in some huge formal program or maybe just in something on the side of their desk that they're trying to challenge?
Yeah, let's dive in. Let's make it practical. I fully agree with you. You know, when we're in the room with three behavioral scientists, it's easy to get really into those lengthy, interesting conversations. But we're talking interventions, right? So first of all, an intervention is when you decide to do something that is different from the status quo. So you're going to change something in an organization. I just want to look back to, I don't think that there are any interventions that are always working better than other interventions. I wouldn't even say that evidence-based interventions are always the best solution, that you should always strive for evidence-based intervention. Our goal is really to just expand the toolkit of professionals, add on to it, and then for yourself, pick what you want to use in which context, on what team, tailor it, don't copy paste it, just, you know, give you another tool in the toolkit. That's really the goal. We're not prescribing anything. We're not preaching anything. That said, one of my favorite interventions is called the pre-mortem. And this is something that should sound very familiar to behavioral scientists. But what we've noticed is that it's not familiar at all to most organizational change managers. A problem in organizational change and in, you know, the world in general, is that even the best decision makers, they often underscope the project that they are making decisions for. They are systematically underscoring how much time is needed, how much resources are needed, how much people are needed for this, how much budget is needed, because we are humans, right? We have a tendency to be optimistic. When we've done something for a very long time, sometimes we have the tendency to be overconfident. In our decision making, there are some fallacies, like planning fallacy, where we're kind of, you know, we're applying that overconfidence and over optimism to how we allocate resources. And in change management, we see that time after time, even the best change managers, they tend to underscope their big changes. That is where the pre-mortem comes in. A pre-mortem is where you take the decision making team, so it's a group exercise. And we as Neurofight, you know, we come in as trainers, as consultants, as change managers. Oftentimes we come in alongside a Big Four consultancy firm, but the organization asks us, we really want the people side done right. That's usually our cue for, okay, we're going to come in. We do a pre-mortem. We try to do it as early in the project as possible, but already at the stage where a planning has been made, we're about to kick off, but let's say a month in advance, we're going to run that pre-mortem. We bring the decision makers into a room. We add some other people as well that can weigh in on this. And we tell them we are 6 months ahead, or maybe 1 year, depending on the project life cycle. And it has gone horribly wrong. And I want you to think with me what that worst case scenario looks like and really do your best. So let's say we have a basic example of a digital transformation in a company or an AI transformation, and you really challenge them. What does that worst case scenario look like? And this is when decision makers, regardless of their role, they become very creative and they're like, oh yeah, well, maybe if it's an AI transformation, maybe the AI has taken over the whole company, or maybe our engineers have resigned because they're overworked. There might be a strike. And this is a fun exercise, but we try to make it as detailed as possible. And then the less fun part comes, and this is where we work backwards. So we ask everyone in silence to come up with some reasons why we are at that worst case scenario, working backwards from the future state to where we are now. And that is where the evidence-based component comes in. This pre-mortem, it's been coined by Gary Klein, the psychologist. It's one of Danny Kahneman's favorites, the late Danny Kahneman's favorites. And it works on this principle of the human brain is really good at saying, I knew that all along. Looking back, it's so logical that we haven't taken all that into account. We're less good at thinking about the future in different scenarios and making a true or accurate assessment of risks. So we're using that principle of our brain being good at knowing it all along in advance. And this is called prospective hindsight. And it sounds difficult, but it's easy and fun to do. But it might get a little intense when you work backwards. And then as a facilitator, you want to make sure that you don't ask the most senior decision maker, the VP, their reasons first. Maybe you want a more junior person to weigh in. So why did we get to that worst case scenario? And you facilitate it in such a way that open, safe conversation and dialogue can take place. But since we have changed the environment in which we talk about risk, the behaviors and the decisions will be changed as well. Because as you say as well, James, if you want to change behavior, change the environment. If you want to have a real conversation about risk, change the environment in which you have that conversation. So we're working backwards and we're asking everyone, what are the reasons? And we've done this plenty of times with big projects in large organizations. And intense conversation often arises, things that have not been discussed before because we're leveraging prospective hindsight, our ability to become really good at saying, I knew that all along, and we're adding it to a group dynamic exercise. We when all these risks are on the table, we ask people to discuss, okay, so which ones are can be clustered, which ones should be prioritized. You often want to take at least 90 minutes for a pre-mortem, but we've also sometimes taken half a day or even a full day if the project is really, like, if it's high stakes, if there's a lot on the table. And then when we've done that exercise, we did the worst case scenario, we traveled backwards, we identified the risks, we made sure that everyone has had their time to think about it independently, written the risks down, and then voicing them. We tried to prioritize the risks, and then, only then, we start coming up with mitigation activities and then contingency plans. And in my experience, 10 out of 10 times, there are lots of new unseen risks on the table right now that have a lot more to do with behavior, that have a lot more to do with the people side of things. Then when we create those mitigation plans, you notice that there is a lot more shared ownership and accountability because we've done this simulation exercise and people are like, no, we can work on that together. We can track it. And of course, this is where you want to be meticulous and assign some types of real world objective metrics to each of those risks that you want to monitor. But that's basic risk practice, right? The trick really lies in doing that pre-mortem thing, traveling to the worst case scenario, working backwards. And then in that way, you find that just before the go live, there is an uncomfortable moment there always. Sometimes you have to send the most senior decision maker out of the room because they are tainting the conversation too much, or you assign them a facilitatory role. But this pre-mortem context, it makes for such more, you know, some more high quality conversations about risk. And it really helps people roll with the changes, which is an REO Speedwagon song from the 80s that you probably know, James. I know you like to make these references here on the podcast. So pre-mortem, it's can be a simple technique. It's an evidence-based intervention rooted in Gary Klein's research. And we find that it's not being used as much in change management yet. But if you have to start with one of the 18 interventions, then this is one that can have such high yields and really set you up for success. And it's quite, you know, it's not rocket science. It's relatively easy to facilitate and it's a lot of fun, although it can get a bit uncomfortable too. And we have a whole step-by-step plan in the book. I highly recommend people, if you want to start experimenting, maybe that's where you want to start.
Yeah. I like that.
Well, that's Philip's bit. Byram, let's hear yours.
Well, I'm not going to top that, but I'm not going to try either. So I think what would be interesting is to pick a different intervention that is, in essence, very simple, and it both contrasts with the premortem and it builds on top of it. So there are different kinds of interventions, and some of them are very facilitation focused, right? This, for example, you bring together a group of people, you want them to be diverse, and then you facilitate the session. Whereas the intervention that I want to talk about, if then plans, is super simple. It's something you can do in a group. It's something that is absolutely also something you can facilitate with an entire group, but it's also something you can do on your own. And maybe if I zoom out, one of the things that I do most when trying to understand, because often you contrast, right? Like you try to understand why a certain behavior is not yet happening. And the three questions that I always ask myself is, can they do it? Can the group do the behavior? Do they want to do it? And do they have a reason to do it now? Right? And usually what you see is that one of those three areas or multiple are the blockers. And I think one of the simplest things that you can do, the if-then plans, it contrasts with pre-mortem because it's something you can do on your own, but it's also something that builds on top of it. So let's say you have done the pre-mortem and a bunch of risks came out. Then you can use the if-then plans because you have already identified the ifs. So in short, it's if X happens, then I do Y, right? So the behavior that you want to see would be something that comes after the then, but you still want to analyze the ifs. And very often you see that finding the right situation in which the behavior takes place is very hard. And that's how this builds on top of the premortem, because the premortem already shows you the situation, or it helps you map more situations that could become an issue. If you have done the behavioral specificity right, you've already thought about what kind of behavior would suit the situation better. And then the if-then plan makes it extremely simple. And I find it very useful exactly because it feels so simple. It's something you can do it in an organization. So it can be complex in terms of if during this meeting, this situation arises, then this person can do, right? So you can build relatively complex if-then plans, but it can also be very simple. If I start my day, then I open Airtable or whatever tool you use in order to do whatever you need, right? So that's something I use all the time on my own. And it's also something we help our clients with. And it's useful exactly because it's so simple.
I love it. Thank you, guys. Those are both really practical, really simple. And I feel like for the listeners who've stuck with us, which is hopefully everyone, we've covered a huge amount of ground. We've gone from anthropology, Lawrence of Arabia, REO Speedwagon, and we've ended up with a couple of really practical, really simple, but really effective evidence-based interventions that people can use.
Thanks, James.
Thank you both. It's been an absolute pleasure. Hopefully the tech gremlins have abated and everyone is hearing this now.
Thank you so much for having us, James. It was a blast.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure.
So as you can probably tell from that episode, I'm a huge fan of Lawrence of Arabia. I actually rewatched the film recently after many years and was delighted to find it's lost none of its brilliance. But it's not just the film. Lawrence's book, Seven Pillars of Wisdom, is an all-time classic. He was such a fascinating character, the quintessential outsider. The book is full of brilliant observations about Arab culture and ways of life, but similarly, also about strange customs and beliefs of Lawrence's fellow British officers. Recognised as a great hero in his own time, and arguably the first global celebrity, the tragedy of Lawrence's life was that he could never escape that outsider status. Far from the fish but can't see the water, Lawrence couldn't stop seeing the water long enough to just swim in it. That kind of outside-in perspective is uncomfortable. But as we heard, it's also very useful because it brings a certain level of humility. As the guy said, applying science in an organizational context doesn't have to mean putting on a lab coat and running formal experiments. But what it does mean is a bit more humility than perhaps we're used to. It means accepting that we don't always have all the answers and that things don't have to be the way they are. As Byron Phillip talked about, it's definitely an advantage to bring a bicultural perspective from your own life, to naturally be something of an outsider. But it's not a prerequisite. In fact, the takeaway from this episode is that we'd all be better off adopting that outsider perspective from time to time. So the question, listener, how are you going to stop, take a moment, think critically? How are you going to put yourself in someone else's shoes, observe from a different vantage point? Question assumptions. How are you going to stop being a fish and start seeing the water? You've been listening to The B Word. Don't forget to leave us a rating or a review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.